Welcome to episode 43 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Jocelyn Chateauvert, a paper artist in South Carolina who manipulates abaca and flax in astounding ways. She discovered hand papermaking while getting her MFA in metals and jewelry at the University of Iowa. We talk about how she started out combining paper and metal, two seemingly disparate materials.
How can I marry these two things? You know, very seeming disparate materials. Something seemingly fragile with something known to be long-lasting and metal. So I set up some parameters when I did that. The number one parameter was that I couldn't glue anything. So I had to cold connect, is what we call it in metalworking, with rivets and links and just tension, so that I could marry the metals together.
Jocelyn then tells me how her work has evolved from jewelry and body adornment to sculpture, installation, and lighting, and how she has come up with a vocabulary for the more than 50 unique techniques she has developed for manipulating paper. Enjoy our conversation. Jocelyn Chateauvert, welcome to Paper Talk. So I think we met in the early 90s at a Friends of Dart Hunter conference. I remember Tim Barrett bringing you over and introducing you to me. And so tell me how you ended up in working with paper.
So I was at the University of Iowa, and this would have been, I must have started in about my grad schooling, I think in 88. And at the time, I was getting an MFA in metalworking and jewelry through Chung Hee Chu. And Tim had virtually just arrived at school.
He'd
been there maybe a year. And I had no interest in paper. I mean, it wasn't even on my radar, though my jewelry education was very avant-garde. And so it was very much about, you know, how jewelry connected with the body and how it could be theatrical on the body or it could be theater upon itself. So I was literally walking down the hall and some professor, and I don't know who, tapped me on the arm and said, "Jess, I think you ought to take that papermaking class." And I was, "Okay, I will." That was it. There was no degree at that time.
Okay.
I think I took an exorbitant number of hours that did not even count towards my degree because it didn't matter anymore.
In paper, you mean?
In paper.
Got hooked. Yeah.
Yeah, I was totally enthralled. Remember about Bridget O'Malley, either came in like a year afterwards or something. There was another woman, I've been trying to think of her name, and I haven't come up with it, but there weren't that many of us. So the studio, which is at the time was in the basement of the Iowa Art Building, was small, well-equipped, of course, and top-notch. But there weren't many people doing anything with it, so it gave a lot of room to be there a lot.
Right.
Kind of move in.
Yeah. Right, right. So tell me how you integrated. I know you started making jewelry with metal and paper, so how did that kind of...
Well, so I graduated... I didn't graduate. I didn't finish my dissertation, but I had an invitation to go teach electroforming in England, in London, at Middlesex Polytechnic, which was a technique that was kind of our showstopper at metalworking. So I went over there, came back, you know, back and forth, ended up in San Francisco through another invitation. And I just, you know, I had to combine the two. I mean, it just seemed my destiny. You know, I had an MFA in metalworking. I now was a paper maker. So I had to bring them together. And that was just, you know, the whole conceptual level of it was, how can I marry these two things? You know, very seeming disparate materials. Something seemingly fragile was something known to be long-lasting and metal. So I had to, I set up some parameters when I did that. The number one parameter was that I couldn't glue anything. Mm. So I had to cold connect, is what we call it in metalworking, with rivets and links and just tension, so that I could marry the metals together.
And why did you set up that parameter?
I thought gluing was tacky.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed too fundamental. It seemed too rudimentary, and it seemed too craft-oriented. I mean, it didn't use all my skills.
Right.
So I did that. And I exhibited within the first, 14 months. And I went to the Baltimore American Craft Wholesale.
Okay, and where were you making paper? In San Francisco?
In my kitchen.
Uh-huh. And what fiber were you using?
So I was ordering beaten pulp.
Okay.
And I think I must have been ordering it from Neil up in Seattle.
Okay. Neil Bonham.
Mm-hmm. Neil Bonham. And so I was using abaca flax actually more often. And then within a year of really making it like a quote unquote production line of jewelry, I went up to Neil and to C Pen Press. And we made paper together, mm-hmm. and I brought it home to make jewelry. So I needed that next echelons of paper, you know, the quality, the density.
So you were using his professional molds and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and production was much quicker than in your kitchen.
Rudimentary, yeah, in my kitchen. And so at the time, you know, that I was working with just dry sheet. And cutting.
Okay.
And then integrating that with the metal in some kind of sleeve, you know, some kind of connection.
Right. And you were you doing the scratching then?
Yes.
You scratched.
Yes, already. I could, you know, I saw that you could draw into the overbeaten sheets. And what happens essentially is it breaks the fiber. And that's what makes the white line.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I still use jewelry tools to this day with my paper because it is so strong. And that's why I'm the Wrangler. Because I mean, it's truly a challenge. I mean, it's a physical challenge to work with it.
Right. And do you, just for listeners, do you still make jewelry, first of all?
I do.
Okay, so we can put some pictures on
sure.
the website. Maybe you have a photo of an older piece. Maybe.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Always.
Okay, yeah, because these are stunning pieces. Okay, so you did was it the ACC craft show in Baltimore?
It was, the American Craft Council show in Baltimore.
And how did that first show go?
People were blown away.
Uh-huh.
They'd never seen anything like it.
Right.
And then I had a really unique booth because I'd taken poultry wire and made walls, and then I'd brought 200 proteas from Hawaii, and I wove them into the surface of the
Proteas are flowers?
It's a flower.
Okay.
A Hawaiian flower.
Oh.
Pincushion proteas, so I made wallpaper.
Wow.
And it was pretty stunning. No lighting. I had no lighting. You know, that was way too high-tech.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, and so I got a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm. And orders.
And orders.
From, you know, so this was from retail stores around the country.
Galleries, museums, shops. Mm-hmm. You know, small orders. They wanted to try a collection of 5 pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Always a lot of earrings. You know, you can always trust making earrings.
Right. Okay, and so... I know you're in Charleston, South Carolina now. So how did this, you know, how did that go? Did you keep doing the ACC shows? And
I did. I only did national juried shows.
Okay.
I tried one time to do a street fair and I about lost my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it told me, you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
I would do, for years, I did the Philadelphia Museum of Arts Craft Show, the Evanston Craft Show, ACC, both San Francisco, Baltimore, once Atlanta, once Minneapolis, and the Smithsonian. Okay, so those were the shows. I mean, that put you on the road 4 and 5 times a year.
Oh, yeah.
And coming up with new collections and expanding collections. So that was, you know, a logistical and creative challenge every few months.
Right.
And so I stayed in San Francisco for a while, but was drawn home to Iowa, where I'm from, mm-hmm. And set up a bigger studio, and I had an assistant, because by then, at the top of that field, of my field then, I was wholesaling to 55 galleries and museums.
Wow. And so did you have a papermaking studio then and a metal shop?
I had metals first, because uh-huh. that's, you know, that was the money generating studio. Slowly I built up, you know, it was my first Tim Moore mold. Mm-hmm. And then I bought a used beater that made me cry, that I had to totally take down and rehab. Oh. And I still have it to this day.
Wow.
It's a champ. It's my champ.
And it's a Valley, right?
It's a Valley beater. Yeah. Vintage, maybe 62.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I've taken that apart and put it back together 2 or 3 times. 3 times now.
Mm-hmm.
So I know every part of it, and I keep upgrading it to stainless.
Right.
If it was bronze.
And when you say the metal studio was the income generator, does that mean you were making just metal pieces in addition to the metal and paper pieces?
No, only paper and metal.
Oh, okay.
I mean, primarily. Mm-hmm. Sure, I did some pure metal, but the drive and what was, you know, what I showed was paper and metal.
Okay, so how long were you in Iowa then?
All the way until 1999. So from about 95 to 99.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved to Charleston in 99, in October.
So you do much more than earrings now. So I want to, or earrings, jewelry. So I want to get into that, how that evolved.
So what was happening, doing so much production work, is my hand started falling asleep at night. Mm. So that was one of your questions, had I ever dealt with it. It's fortunately, I've never suffered from any actual papermaking injuries, but the tool work of metalworking and small-scale metalworking did a number. And that's when I started, you know, the abaca, I didn't pigment. I rarely pigment it. Let me put it that way. Occasionally black, occasionally red, nothing else.
Right.
All natural, but the variety. So premium, unbleached, and bleached.
Mm-hmm.
And flax. I was drawn to light, so I started making lighting.
Mm-hmm.
And that evolved. It's still evolving. In fact, I just finished a commission of lighting. So that's still part of my work. And, you know, you just want to work bigger. You can't help it. So I do. So, you know, it's always been like a little of this, a majority of that, a little more of that, you know. And so it's like sculpture, installation, jewelry, lighting.
Right. And do you have I share your interest in lighting, and I think, do you know where that comes from for you? Is it from the material?
Because it's from the material. It demands light.
Yeah.
And the way I designed the jewelry pieces were to receive light. So when it was on the body, there was light coming through. Somehow that was integrated into the wearing of the work.
Well, let's talk about your installation that you did.
Artfields,
yeah. Invasive species. And maybe we can just really dive into everything from how many sheets of paper you made. Because you work in components. I think everything is components. And
yeah,
a lot of paper artists like want to make the biggest sheet. And I've done that. And oh, yeah, that's not for me. So I really appreciate how you, you know, you have, what size sheets are you making?
For all right. So I have two Tim Moore molds now. Uh-huh. I've only ever had two. I have various screens, but my molds are my standard. And that was recommended by Gloria Smolik-Smith. Mm-hmm. I was determined to start off with a, 24 by 30.
Oh,
you know, that was, that was going to be my mold size. And she's looking at me, you know, and she's, 10 or 12 years older than myself. Uh-huh. She said, then you need a bigger press and you need bigger vats and you need bigger felt. And I went, oh yeah. So 18 by 24. I work in 18 by 24 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And the, going to the installation of invasive species, that was a real culmination of my experience with paper. In that, there were 300 morning glories, mm-hmm. and they ranged in size from about 2 inches in diameter to 6 feet. But they were all constructed in the same manner. And they were all based on the triangle. So the point being that there was no waste. I didn't cut away any part of the paper. I used the deco edge. I cut along the lengthwise from corner to corner, flip it over, and start piecing these together.
So you would cut an 18 by 24 in a diagonal.
And that was one size. Mm-hmm. But then you could cut it in the middle and do that diagonal. All or right. you could put two together and cut that on the diagonal. Or three together and cut that, right? Because you still have 18 to 25% shrinkage, right?
Right. So you're air drying everything. And let's unpack this a little bit. So you mentioned the paper wrangler, which you call yourself, because, you are manipulating paper in such interesting ways, pleating it, folding it, and all while it's wet. So tell me first about the how you got invited to do this installation.
Well, I wasn't invited. It was an application.
Okay.
I was it the first time that it was installed, though I will go back in time by 2 years. And I was asked to do an installation at Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that was the first genesis of this installation. 2 years later, I was applied to be in Art Fields, which is an 11-state Southern arts competition.
Okay.
And I had been invited the first year that it was the inaugural year. And then 2 years later, I applied and I got in. Well, of course, once you've done it one way, you kind of want to do it another way. So what I introduced the second time was miniature morning glories, because I'd been really learning the technique to the tiniest little things.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed that. So I integrated all sizes. So I'm at Art Fields, and it's an old mercantile store with beautiful wooden beams. So I make the morning glories.
Did you visit the space first, or had you only seen
it? I'd already seen it. I had already been there. But, you go, but you forget.
Yeah, right.
And then the dimensions. I mean, it did end up being 55 feet long, 16 feet high, and 14 feet wide. So there were a lot of them. But you don't know. I was there for 7 days installing, because I'm kind of jumping around.
So you saw the space. You kind of envisioned. How did you decide how many? Did you make extras?
I made 200 small ones in addition to the 200 or 300 that I already had. Now, when I make these morning glories, they're all dried flat, okay? And the wrangling comes in because I have to pull them apart to
open them
up. So what do you mean
dried flat?
So I'm piecing these triangles together to make that shape of the petal.
Okay.
And they're either 6... or 4 or 8 or 12
Triangles
pieced together to open up, right?
Okay.
I dry them flat. They're just laid on top of each other. So, you know, shit, it took me, when I got to Iowa, it took me 3 days to open them, just to open them.
Because they're kind of stuck together.
Yeah, when they're flat. And I want full three dimensions.
Right. But when you're, before they dry, when they're wet, you're connecting the edges, the seams.
I am. I roll them.
Roll the seams.
So yeah. Every edge is hand rolled.
And you're cutting these triangles with a rotary cutter?
Rotary cutter on a resealable mat.
Okay.
Or multiple resealable mats, depending on scale. And I use the shrinkage as the binding.
Right.
So there's actually no glue.
Right.
And so then the flower has dried, and then there's, you know, a stem, and that's when I would add, or there's an end, and I would add a stem, a wet stem to the dry flower.
And yes. Stem is paper. Everything is paper in this
installation. Everything in this installation is paper.
Even the rope or the stems connected
everything
to each other.
There's nothing else. There's no other material, which is what really turns me on. When you can make that happen.
Right.
People think there must be wire inside. It is so strong. They think, well, and then I can manipulate it and reshape it. And one flower folds in on an edge, on a petal, and I want it going out again. I decide to, you know, they can evolve. So.
Right. And so it looked to me, I looked at pictures of invasive species, and there were these big boxes, and I was envisioning that you did some of the opening in your studio, and then you were able to stack and nest. Is that right or wrong? No,
I
so
sent them
just
all
the
flat.
Sheet. You sent them all flat. Wow.
I sent them all flat, and then I had to send them all back opened. Nesting is a desired concept, but not with a stem.
Right.
And then the stems are different lengths, right? Some are 6 feet long, some are 2 feet long, some are curling, and then I integrated leaves. And no, it's just it's just freight. It just becomes freight.
Right.
You're shipping freight in big 4x4x4 boxes. I now have 9 4x4x4 boxes in storage.
But this installation won an award, correct?
It did. There were 4 top awards at this competition. They've since expanded it. But I won the People's Choice, three-dimensional. So that meant that, you know, and people vote. So it's like Art Prize in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was based on. That was the model.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I got that was fun, you know.
Yeah.
That's fun. People loved it. Because you could walk through it. It was immersive.
Mm-hmm.
There was a brick wall where the baby ones were sticking out like they had taken over. They were growing in from the outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah, it's got a real feel to it. People relate. And they are invasive, and they are here in South Carolina.
Uh-huh. Right.
So, you know, it's part of it. Part of the landscape.
Right. And so you've done several installations. Are you always, are you invited sometimes, or do you look for calls? How do they come about? And permanent commissions too, I think, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about The Paper Year, a new monthly planner that will be coming out early this fall. I'm rebranding the 12 Months of Paper calendar, which you might be familiar with, a how-to book and calendar featuring a paper project every month. The Paper Year is a wire-bound book still featuring 12 paper projects, and this year, 5 of the projects are designed by guest artists. I can't wait to share them with you. Stay tuned for more info, and there will be information about the upcoming edition of this book at bit.ly/12monthsofpaper. Where you'll also find 2019 calendars available at half price.
After a while, you actually get a reputation.
Yes. Well, that's important to hear because You know. I'm finding that too. We're similar age, and
that's right.
We both stuck at what we're doing.
And over 30 years.
Logged and barely made money. And then, yeah.
And we're experts.
And having to push, try for things. But then at a certain point, you start to get a reputation. Yay. Yeah.
I applied for the competition because, it's the only money game in the state. I mean, we don't have a lot of money for the arts in South Carolina. They don't dedicate much money. So, but I've done two hospital commissions here. And maybe it started at the Smithsonian when I was at the Smithsonian in 2007 in an exhibit called From the Ground Up.
At the Renwick.
Mm-hmm. And there I did one of the, it was a very large exhibition, and I was thrilled because I got to make new work for it. But I had done a room full of lily pads. Mm-hmm. And those ended up being in a hospital here in a chapel.
Oh.
So, you know, things move around. But... you know, I'm just available. Maybe that's part of the reputation. Uh-huh. And I always work on time. I've never been a day late. Uh-huh. So
you're reliable. Yeah.
Very. Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm kind of a turnkey kind of artist. I, because I never wanted to be, I'm so self-sufficient. Uh-huh. And I like that because it gives me most satisfaction probably and some other psychological stuff, but I know the material so well now that I think it's important to know it better than your clients. You know, mm-hmm. It's hard for them to know, but when they see how efficient and how beautiful, it makes more sense to them because, you know, so often they want to, you know, it's such a conversation. Well, will it last? And what if?
Yeah, I want to talk about that. Permanence and dusting and what do you tell them? It's that like any material gets dust or any.
You know, it just doesn't really show.
Right.
Yeah. In the installations, I mean, I always recommend those old time drafting brushes, mm-hmm. you know, that are about 12 inches long. Those are lovely to right. dust things right. with. But there's so much texture in my work. Mm-hmm. There's no reflection, right?
Right?
So you don't notice when it's dull,
right.
that it's, yeah, I don't. You've been there.
Yeah. So I want to hear a little bit about your manipulation techniques and sort of how those came about. And I'm curious whether you have a vocabulary because you do all these different, the rolling you mentioned, rolling the seams, but you do pleating.
What are my trade secrets, Helen?
No, just a general.
I'm teasing.
Just a general.
So I had a private student come in February. For the uh-huh. first time to uh-huh. my studios for a week.
Yeah.
I had met her. I gave a workshop at Haystack in Maine. And she was not in my workshop. She was across the deck, but became entranced and wrote a grant and came down. Mm-hmm. So I realized that in my mind, I have a vocabulary, but then when kind of needed to be written down or some consistency that wasn't related to a particular project, right? Like that thingy that I do when I'm doing that, right? So I've developed a vocabulary. It deserves one. I mean, mm-hmm. it is. There are so many techniques. I think I taught her over 50 techniques.
Wow.
Because it's like I said, you could manipulate a morning glory into a dead morning glory if you wanted to. You could fold it all in upon itself and just have it languish. Or you could perk it up and just make it like it just is reaching the sun in its zenith. So you can always go back in. You
right.
can just always go back in and do something more. And I think that has been the longer conversation I'm now having with paper, that it's not just ta-da, it's like, oh, but. So I consequently have a studio full of elements, of course, right? Because, and I've got some stuff, but I'm able to pull from it, and even things that seemed very nascent at the beginning, and if they've held their interest to me over the years and they're still available, then I can go back in and maybe do something more. So it's working wet, it's working dry, it's working wet on dry. I mean, it's this, you know, it's partially dry, it's pulp, right?
Right.
'Cause I did that too, and I built my own vacuum table 2 years ago.
Oh.
So that's, now I've added that into what I'm doing.
And how are you using the vacuum table specifically? Like, why did you build it?
I built it to make a kelp field.
Ah.
So it was squeeze bottles on the Pellon that then I dried on a clothesline, but I rippled the Pellon and it dried in the shape of kelp in water. So that's when I know I'm in the right place doing the right thing, because the paper does it for me. In fact, it consistently does it better than I even envisioned. And boy, does that keep you in a field. I mean, it has kept my interest, because I always think, oh, what if? And then it says, ta-da! I'm like, oh, thank you. You know, so like the rolling technique, I'll go back into that, because I've done a whole series called the ribbed series. Mm-hmm. And the point of that is contracting the fiber through rolling techniques. And then once it's, and doing it when it's wet, press not dry. And then when it's dry, unfurling those coils, right? Because that's what it's done. You've contracted the paper, and then you can open it up.
Right.
And you can decide where you're going to open it up, and you can transform the shape. Mm-hmm. So that's how I see these techniques more fully now. They're more fuller potential, is that you're bringing things together and then opening them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's.
I was just going to ask whether you feel like that relates to the metalworking at all. Does that come from the way you work with metal? I'm not even sure how you do that. Are you pounding metal or pouring?
No, I don't pound. No, I was more of, I love to use the handsaw. So pierce work, it's called.
Okay.
That was a big part of my work, pierce work. Soldering, of course. Making my own elements.
Mm-hmm.
But not necessarily from scratch. You know, but like taking a piece of tubing and bending it and cutting slits into it and making it my own. So okay. I've always kind of taken maybe something that seemed more manufactured and then made it my own. But, right. but you know, for not for its own sake, but for the concept.
Right.
Like if you take a jeweler's saw and you cut little tiny slits around the circumference of a piece of tubing, it looks like a vacuum cleaner hose. And so I did a whole series of vacuum cleaners called When Life Sucks.
Uh-huh.
And they were at the Smithsonian, in fact.
Oh, perfect.
And it was an upright and a canister. And, you know, I had all the different attachments.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, I haven't worked on that series for a while. But for the time, it was
right.
fun. And then you could put in paper bags, right?
Yeah.
So.
You mentioned color, that you don't use a lot of color.
But now I do.
Yeah, so I wanted to hear, like, how that came in. And
it came in when I started using the vacuum table. And it's so intense. And it's so lively, and it's so.
And was it to make this kelp or something else?
Yes, in part. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the kelp is 9 different colors.
Mm.
So it was a gradation of greens and then some purple for some like dark shadow, deep water, a golden. So, you know, yeah. And then I started integrating sea anemones. And so then that suggested, you know, bright iridescent pinks and oranges and poppies. Then it turned into poppies, and you know, it's always nature, Helen, no matter what I do. It just, besides the vacuum cleaners, but yeah, mostly it's nature that paper, you know, yeah, from plants to plants, right? That's kind of the evolution of my work, is plants to plants.
Right. And so do you have a lot of kelp on the in South Carolina on the beach?
No, we have no kelp.
No kelp. Okay. So it's not necessarily related to your walking outside and...
No, it did relate to me kayaking with the otters on my birthday in Morro Bay in California.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So and what was the kelp made for?
So the kelp was made for an installation that I did for another year, last year at Art Fields.
Okay.
I did a kelp forest. It actually kind of morphed into a mermaid, which was quite surprising to me, because if you told me 30 years ago I was going to make a mermaid, I would have said, oh no, I'm way too sophisticated for that. Right? I mean, oh. But she was a 18-foot mermaid with a kelp, in kelp.
Mm-hmm. And so, what are you working on now?
So now I'm doing a different thing. Now I'm taking elements, partially done on the vacuum table, partially from my archives, and I'm sewing them onto stretched linen canvases.
Oh, hand sewing?
Yeah, with wax linen thread.
Mm-hmm.
For a high relief wall piece thing.
Oh, cool. So it's like a rectangle, but maybe it goes off the edges because
It goes off the, of course, yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they're very sea-like, I'd say. They have certainly a sea factor going on.
And is this for an exhibition or?
Just my work.
Just your work. You're just making it.
Yeah, I'm just making it. Mm-hmm. Because I did a commission for a restaurant in Charlotte that was lighting, and there were seven drums. The largest was 50 inches in diameter.
I think I've seen a picture. We can post that on the podcast.
And those took a lot of work. Those, you know, and you actually asked me a question I never answered, like the Morning Glories. How many sheets? I made over 1,000 sheets for the Morning Glories the first time. Mm-hmm. Then I did another probably 600 sheets to continue. So, you know, on a busy year, I probably make 5,000 sheets of paper.
Wow. Yeah. And so you're making these in batches. Like how many sheets do you make in a day?
I used to make 100.
Yeah.
I backed off a little, you know, but 60 is a good run.
Okay. I don't like to make more than 30, and I'm making smaller sheets than you are. So you're a workhorse. And your sheets are a lot heavier too. So
And I beat it all. Yeah. And it's only a pound beater.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you'll do paper making for a day, and then you'll work with those sheets for how many days?
Till they're gone.
Till they're gone. And how do you keep them in between?
In the refrigerator.
You keep them in the refrigerator? Do you interleave anything?
No.
They're just pressed.
They're just pressed, and I stack them right on top of each other. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're leaved with plastic and pressed thin, you know, quarter-inch ply press boards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they're wrapped in plastic again. But my refrigerator is at the perfect temperature, so, you know, I don't run into molding problems very often.
Right.
But often when I'm making that number of sheets, of course, there's a reason. So they are quickly into production because even though it may last in the refrigerator, it changes, you know, subtly. Yeah. In color. So it's important if I'm doing a commission of similar pieces that it's like all
consistent. Yeah.
Yes.
Do you ever hire assistants or do you have an assistant?
I don't now, but yes, I have. I always have to teach people here about papermaking. Sure. I have no resource here.
Right.
But people have stepped up to the vat and done well with it. Mm-hmm. You know, and in something like a Morning Glory installation, no two are the same anyway. So right. It doesn't have to be perfectly consistent, and it wouldn't look like nature if it did.
Right.
So those inherent kind of inconsistencies are part of it.
Mm-hmm. And so you involve an assistant in most aspects of the construction, from paper making to no?
If I hire an assistant, they do one of two things.
Okay.
Either I teach them how to make paper.
Mm-hmm.
Usually we start with a deckle box and then go to the mold because my molds are so precious. I want right. to see how they're handling things before yeah. I'm willing to relinquish their use and care.
Yep. Yep.
And install. Okay. Mm-hmm. So install, of course, that's always. Most of the time I'm on a cherry picker. So, you know, somebody comes and they hand me elements and I install them. But so those two aspects, but in the studio per se, no,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, because that's a different skill set.
Sure.
And it's a finesse that.
Right. Well, you were just saying that no two Morning Glories are the same, but you were referring to the paper.
For right? itself.
The paper itself. Yeah.
Right.
Got it. Yeah. 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 Okay. Well, anything else you want to share with me before we sign off?
Let's see. So now what am I going to do next?
Yeah.
That's what you were going to ask me. What am I going to do next?
Well, so, I asked you what you were doing. So
yes.
But you have something on the horizon.
Well, I'm starting. My son has just gone off to college. And uh-huh. So, you know, this all of a sudden avails me to go elsewhere.
Right.
So I'm starting to apply for residencies and to see what that looks like. Mm. You've done a fair number of those, haven't you, Helen?
No, not really. I'm in the same boat. My daughter's just yes. graduating and I haven't felt like I could go. And plus I have my own studio. I know that's not the only reason to go to a residency. You get to meet other people. But what's attracting you to go? Because you have your workspace.
I think inspiration.
Inspiration. Yeah.
You know, I think just having a different landscape,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
seeing how that could influence new forms,
mm-hmm.
facilities, you know, right. bigger sheets of paper. Because when your paper shrinks 25%, you know, think of those Morning Glories that were 6 feet. They were bigger before yeah. they got to be that big. So you know, having a bigger studio would be really nice. But there's not, you know, we don't have that many options when you're a paper maker of places to go in the world, but there are a few. So I'm tapping knowns first.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Well, hey, it's been super fun having you on, and we'll put lots of photos and links to your website and installations because listeners, Jocelyn's work is out of this world. One of my favorites.
I know. So. You've been such a great supporter, Helen. I hope you find others. We need lots. We deserve to spread our, I think that's part of it too. You know, it's time to start kind of sharing what I've been developing.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, when was that? 2014. We were in Fabriano, Italy, at the IATMA yes. Congress.
Yes,
you were very generous in showing your techniques, and I think you spent a whole half a day making sheets of paper for your demonstration.
Oh, because that was rough. Press. And being in at Fabriano making paper only on top of the mountain.
Yeah, we're going to put that photo I saw. I got the photo credit on your website.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I have a good one of the demonstration from above. Somebody took it from above.
Oh, nice. Yeah, because there's that balcony.
Yeah, beautiful.
Well, very cool.
I hope to see you soon, Helen. Thank you for thinking of me for the podcast. This is my very first.
Yay. Okay. Well, thanks for coming on.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.